4. Bridgeton High Street. 1. Highland Lake. 2. Harrison. 3. Waterford. 6. Sweden. 9. Lovell. 18. Freiburg. 24. They had just passed this sign when Eddie said, "Root around in the glove compartment a little, Roland. See if Ka or the Beam or whatever left us a little spare change for the payphone." "Glove? You mean this panel here?" "Yeah." Roland first tried to turn the chrome button on the front, then got with the program and pushed it. The inside was a mare's nest that hadn't been improved by the galaxy's brief period of weightlessness. There were credit card receipts, a very old tube of what Eddie identified as toothpaste. Roland could make out the words Holmes Dental on it quite clearly. A photograph showing a smiling little girl, Cullum's niece, mayhap, on a pony. A stick of what he first took for explosive. Eddie said it was a road flare for emergencies. A magazine that appeared to be called Yank Me. And a cigar box. Roland couldn't quite make out the word on this, although he thought it might be Trolls. He showed the box to Eddie, whose eyes lit up. "That says Tolls," he said. "Maybe you're right about Cullum and Ka. Open it up, Roland, do it please you." The child who had given this box as a gift had crafted a loving and rather clumsy catch on the front to hold it closed. Roland slipped the catch, opened the box, and showed Eddie a great many silver coins. "Is it enough to call Cy Cullum's house?" "Yeah," Eddie said. "Looks like enough to call Fairbanks, Alaska. It won't help us a bit, though, if Cullum's on the road to Vermont." 5. The Bridgeton town square was bounded by a drugstore and a pizza joint on one side, a movie theater, the Magic Lantern, and a department store, Rennie's, on the other. Between the theater and the department store was a little plaza equipped with benches and 3 payphones. Eddie swept through Cullum's box of toll change and gave Roland $6.25. "I want you to go over there," he said, pointing at the drugstore, "and get me a tin of aspirin. Will you know it when you see it?" "Aspirin. I'll know it." "The smallest size they have is what I want, because $6 really isn't much money. Then go next door to that place that says Bridgeton Pizza and Sandwiches. If you've still got at least 16 of those money coins left, tell them you want a hoagie." Roland nodded, which wasn't good enough for Eddie. "Let me hear you say it."
"Hoagie."
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 "Ho—" Eddie quit. "Roland, let me hear you say poor boy."
"Poor boy."
"Good. If you have at least 16 quarters left, ask for a poor boy. Can you say lots of mayo?"
"Lots of mayo."
"Yeah. If you have less than 16, ask for a salami and cheese sandwich. Sandwich, not a popkin."
"Salami sandwich."
"Close enough. And don't say anything else unless you absolutely have to." Roland nodded. Eddie was right. It would be better if he did not speak. People only had to look at him to know, in their secret hearts, that he wasn't from these parts. They also had a tendency to step away from him. Better he not exacerbate that. The gunslinger dropped a hand to his left hip as he turned toward the street, an old habit that paid no comfort this time. Both revolvers were in the trunk of Cullum's Galaxy, wrapped in their cartridge belts. Before he could get going again, Eddie grabbed his shoulder. The gunslinger swung round, eyebrows raised, faded eyes on his friend. "We have a saying in our world, Roland. We say, so-and-so was grasping at straws."
"And what does it mean?"
"This," Eddie said bleakly. "What we're doing. Wish me good luck, fella." Roland nodded.
"Aye, so I do. Both of us."
He began to turn away, and Eddie called him back again. This time, Roland wore an expression of faint impatience. "Don't get killed crossing the street," Eddie said, and then briefly mimicked Cullum's way of speaking. "Summer folks are thicker than ticks on a dog, and they're not riding horses."
"Make your call, Eddie," Roland said,
and then crossed Bridgeton's high street with slow confidence, walking in the same rolling gait that had taken him across 1,000 other high streets in 1,000 small towns. Eddie watched him, then turned to the telephone and consulted the directions. After that, he lifted the receiver and dialed the number for directory assistance. 6. He didn't go, the gunslinger had said, speaking of John Cullum with flat certainty.
And why? Because Cullum was the end of the line. There was no one else for them to call. Roland of Gilead's damned old car, in other words. After a brief wait, the directory assistance operator coughed up Cullum's number. Eddie tried to memorize it. He'd always been good at remembering numbers. Henry had sometimes called him Little Einstein. But this time he couldn't be confident of his ability. Something seemed to have happened either to his thinking processes in general, which he didn't believe, or to his ability to remember certain artifacts of this world, which he sort of did. As he asked for the number a second time, and wrote it in the gathered dust on the phone kiosk's little ledge, Eddie found himself wondering if he'd still be able to read a novel, or follow the plot of a movie from the succession of images on a screen. He rather doubted it. And what did it matter? The magic lantern next door was showing Star Wars, and Eddie thought that if he made it to the end of his life's path and into the clearing without another look at Luke Skywalker and another listen to Darth Vader's noisy breathing, he'd still be pretty much okay. "Thanks, ma'am," he told the operator, and was about to dial again when there was a series of explosions behind him. Eddie whirled, heart rate spiking, right hand dipping, expecting to see wolves or harriers or maybe that son-of-a-bitch flag. What he saw was a convertible filled with laughing, goofy-faced high school boys with sunburned cheeks. One of them had just tossed out a string of firecrackers left over from the 4th of July, what kids their age in Caliburn Sturgis would have called bangers. "If I'd had a gun on my hip, I might have shot a couple of those bucks," Eddie thought. "You want to talk goofy, start with that." Yes. Well, and maybe he might not have. Either way, he had to admit the possibility that he was no longer exactly safe in the more civilized quarters. "Live with it," Eddie murmured, then added the great sage and eminent junkie's favorite advice for life's little problems. "Deal." He dialed John Cullum's number on the old-fashioned rotary phone, and when a robot voice, Blaine the Mono's great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, mayhap, asked him to deposit 90 cents, Eddie dropped in a buck. What the hell, he was saving the world. The phone rang once, rang twice, and was picked up. "John!" Eddie almost yelled. "Good fucking deal, John, this is—" But the voice on the other end was already speaking. As a child of the late 80s, Eddie knew this did not bode well.
"Have reached John Cullum of Cullum Caretaken and Camp Check-in," said Cullum's voice in its familiar slow Yankee drawl. "I got called away, kind of sudden, don't you know, and can't say with any degree of certainty just when I'll be back. If this inconveniences you, I beg pardon, but you can call Gary Kroll at 926-5555 or Junior Barker at 929-4211.
Eddie's initial dismay had departed. Departed, Cullum himself would have said. Right around the time the man's wavery recorded voice was telling Eddie that he, Cullum, couldn't say with any degree of certainty when he'd be back. Because Cullum was right there, in his hobbity little cottage on the western shore of Keewaddin Pond, either sitting on his overstuffed hobbity sofa or in one of the two similarly overstuffed hobbity chairs. Sitting there, and monitoring messages on his no-doubt clunky mid-70s answering machine. And Eddie knew this because, well, because he just knew. The primitive recording couldn't completely hide the sly humor that had crept into Cullum's voice by the end of the message. "Cos, if you're still set on talking to nobody but yours truly, you can leave me a message at the beep. Keep it short." Eddie waited for the beep and then said, "It's Eddie Dean, John. I know you're there, and I think you've been waiting for my call. Don't ask me why I think that, because I don't really know, but—" There was a loud click in Eddie's ear, and then Cullum's voice, his live voice, said, "Hello there, son. You taking good care of my car?" For a moment, Eddie was too bemused to reply, for Cullum's down-east accent had turned the question into something quite different. "You taking good care of my car?" "Boy," Cullum asked, suddenly concerned, "you still on the wire?" "Yeah," Eddie said, "and so are you. I thought you were going to Vermont, John." "Well, I tell you what, this place ain't seen a day this exciting probably since South Stoneham's shoe burnt down in 1923. The cops have got all the roads out of town blocked off." Eddie was sure they were letting folks through the roadblocks if they could show proper identification, but he ignored that issue in favor of something else.
Want to tell me you couldn't find your way out of that town without seeing a single cop if it suited your fancy?
There was a brief pause. In it, Eddie became aware of someone at his elbow. He didn't turn to look. It was Roland. Who else in this world would smell, subtly but unquestionably, of another world?
Oh, well,
Cullum said at last.
Maybe I do know a woods road or two that come out over in Lovell. It's been a dry summer, and I guess I could get my truck up 'em.
One or two?
Well, say three or four.
A pause, which Eddie didn't break. He was having too much fun.
Five or six,
Cullum amended, and Eddie chose not to respond to this either.
Eight,
Cullum said at last, and when Eddie laughed, Cullum joined in.
What's on your mind, son?
Eddie glanced at Roland, who was holding out a tin of aspirin between the two remaining fingers of his right hand. Eddie took it gratefully.
I want you to come over to Lovell, he said to Cullum. Seems like we might have a little more palavering to do after all.
Aye, and it seems like I must have known it,
Cullum said.
Although it was never right up on the top of my mind. Up there I kept thinking I'll be getting on the road to Montpelier soon. And still I kept finding one more thing and one more thing to do around here. If you'd have called 5 minutes ago, you would have gotten a busy. I was on the phone to Charlie Beamer. It was his wife and sister-in-law that got killed in the market, don't you know? And then I thought, what the hell, I'll just give the whole place a good sweep before I put my gear in the back of the truck and go. Nothing up on top is what I'm saying, but down underneath I guess I've been waiting for your call ever since I got back here. Will you be, Turtleback Lane?
Eddie popped open the aspirin tin and looked greedily at the little lineup of tablets. Once a junkie, always a junkie, he reckoned, even when it came to this stuff.
Aye, he said, with his tongue only partly in his cheek.
He'd become quite the mimic of regional dialects since meeting Roland on a Delta jet descending into Kennedy Airport.
You said that lane was nothing but a 2-mile loop off Route 7, didn't you?
So I did.
Some very nice homes along Turtleback.
A brief, reflective pause.
And a lot of 'em for sale. There's been quite a number of walk-ins in that part of the world just lately. As I may have also mentioned, such things make folks nervous. And rich folks, at least, can afford to get away from what makes it hard to sleep at night.
Eddie could wait no longer. He took three of the aspirin and tossed them into his mouth, relishing the bitter taste as they dissolved on his tongue. Bad as the pain currently was, he would have borne twice as much if he could have heard from Susanna. But she was quiet. He had an idea that the line of communication between them, chancy at best, had ceased to exist with the coming of Mia's damned baby.
You boys might want to keep your shooting irons close at hand if you're headed over to Turtleback and Lovell, Cullum said. As for me, I think I'll just toss my shotgun in my truck before I set sail.
Why not?
Eddie agreed.
You want to look for your car along the loop, okay? You'll find it.
Aye, that old galaxy's hard to miss,
Cullum agreed.
Tell me something, son. I'm not going to Vermont, but I got a feeling you mean to send me somewhere if I agree to go. You mind telling me where?
Eddie thought that Mark Twain might elect to call the next chapter of John Cullum's no doubt colorful life a Maine Yankee in the Crimson King's Court, but elected not to say so.
Have you ever been in New York City? Gorry, yes. Had a 48-hour pass there when I was in the Army. Went to Radio City Music Hall and the Empire State Building, that much I remember. Must have made a few other tourist stops, though, because I lost $30 out of my wallet, and a couple of months later I got diagnosed with a pretty fine case of the clap.
This time you'll be too busy to catch the clap. Bring your credit cards. I know you have some because I got a look at the receipts in your glove compartment. He felt an almost insane urge to draw the last word out, make it compartment.
Mess in there, ain't it?
Cullum asked equably.
Yeah, looks like what was left when the dog chewed the shoes. See you in Lovell, John.
Eddie hung up. He looked at the bag Roland was carrying and lifted his eyebrows. It's a poor boy's sandwich, Roland said, with lots of mayo, whatever that is. I'd want a sauce that didn't look quite so much like cum myself, but may it do you fine. Eddie rolled his eyes.
Gosh, that's a real appetite builder.
Do you say so? Eddie had to remind himself once more that Roland had almost no sense of humor.
I do. Come on, I can eat my cum and cheese sandwich while I drive. Also, we need to talk about how we're going to handle this.
7.
The way to handle it, both agreed, was to tell John Cullum as much of their tale as they thought his credulity and sanity could stand. Then, if all went well, they would entrust him with the vital bill of sale and send him to Aaron Deepnow, with strict orders to make sure he spoke to Deepnow apart from the not entirely trustworthy Calvin Tower. "Cullum and Deepnow can work together to track Moses Carver down," Eddie said, "and I think I can give Cullum enough information about Sue's private stuff to convince Carver that she's still alive. After that, though, well, a lot depends on how convincing those two guys can be, and how eager they are to work for the Tet Corporation in their sunset years. Hey, they may surprise us. I can't see Cullum in a suit and tie, but traveling around the country and throwing monkey wrenches in Sombra's business?" He considered, head cocked, then nodded with a smile. "Yeah, I can see that pretty well." "Susanna's godfather's apt to be an old codger himself," Roland observed. "Just one of a different color. Such fellows often speak their own language when they're antet. And mayhap I can give John Cullum something that'll help convince Carver to throw in with us. A sigil?" "Yes." Eddie was intrigued. "What kind?" But before Roland could answer, they saw something that made Eddie stomp on the brake pedal. They were in Lovell now, and on Route 7. Ahead of them, staggering unsteadily along the shoulder, was an old man with snarled and straggly white hair. He wore a clumsy wrap of dirty cloth that could by no means be called a robe. His scrawny arms and legs were whipped with scratches. There were sores on them as well, burning a dull red. His feet were bare and equipped with ugly and dangerous-looking yellow talons instead of toes. Clasped under one arm was a splintery wooden object that might have been a broken lyre. Eddie thought no one could have looked more out of place on this road, where the only pedestrians they had seen so far were serious-looking exercisers, obviously from away, looking ever so put together in their nylon jogging shorts, baseball hats, and T-shirts. One jogger's shirt bore the legend, "Don't shoot the tourists." The thing that had been trudging along the berm of Route 7 turned toward them, and Eddie let out an involuntary cry of horror. Its eyes bled together above the bridge of its nose, reminding him of a double-yolked egg in a fry pan. A fang depended from one nostril like a bone booger. Yet somehow, worst of all, was the dull green glow that baked out from the creature's face. It was as if its skin had been painted with some sort of thin fluorescent gruel. It saw them, and immediately dashed into the woods, dropping its splintered lyre behind. "Christ!" Eddie screamed. If that was a walk-in, he hoped never to see another. "Stop, Eddie!" Roland shouted, then braced the heel of one hand against the dashboard as Cullum's old Ford slid to a dusty halt close to where the thing had vanished. "Open the back hold," Roland said as he opened the door. "Get my widowmaker."
"Roland, we're in kind of a hurry here, and Turtleback Lane's still 3 miles north. I really think we ought to—"
"Shut your fool's mouth and get it,"
Roland roared, then ran to the edge of the woods. He drew a deep breath, and when he shouted after the rogue creature, his voice sent gooseflesh racing up Eddie's arms. He had heard Roland speak so once or twice before, but in between it was easy to forget that the blood of a king ran in his veins. He spoke several phrases Eddie could not understand, then one he could.
"So come forth, ye child of Roderick, ye spoiled, ye lost, and make your bow before me, Roland, son of Stephen, of the line of Eld."
For a moment there was nothing. Eddie opened the Ford's trunk and brought Roland his gun. Roland strapped it on without so much as a glance at Eddie, let alone a word of thanks. Perhaps 30 seconds went by. Eddie opened his mouth to speak. Before he could, the dusty roadside foliage began to shake. A moment or two later, the misbegotten thing reappeared. It staggered with its head lowered. On the front of its robe was a large wet patch. Eddie could smell the reek of a sick thing's urine, wild and strong. Yet it made a knee and raised one misshapen hand to its forehead, a doomed gesture of fealty that made Eddie feel like weeping.
"Hail, Roland of Gilead! Roland of Eld! Will you show me some sigil, dear?"
In a town called River Crossing, an old woman who called herself Aunt Talitha had given Roland a silver cross on a fine link silver chain. He'd worn it around his neck ever since. Now he reached into his shirt and showed it to the kneeling creature. A slow mutie, dying of radiation sickness, Eddie was quite sure. And the thing gave a cracked cry of wonder.
"Would you have peace at the end of your course, thou child of Roderick? Would you have the peace of the clearing?"
"Aye, my dear,"
it said, sobbing, then added a great deal more in some gibberish tongue Eddie couldn't understand. Eddie looked both ways along Route 7, expecting to see traffic. This was the height of the summer season, after all, but spied nothing in either direction. For the moment, at least, their luck still held.
"How many of you are there in these parts?"
Roland asked, interrupting the walk-in. As he spoke, he drew his revolver and raised that old engine of death until it lay against his shirt. The child of Roderick tossed its hand at the horizon without looking up.
"De la gunslinger," he said. "For here the worlds are thin. Se anro confa, se de sinfano bilet cobecan. I cheven divardando because I felt sat for them. Cantoi canta, can discordia, aven la cam macan. Maimi, ifen la venen, if—"
"How many dandivar?"
It thought about Roland's question, then spread its fingers. There were 10, Eddie noted. 5 times. 50. Although 50 of what, Eddie didn't know.
"And discordia?" Roland asked sharply. "Do you truly say so?"
"Oh, aye. So says me, Cheven of Cheven, son of Hamil, minstrel of the South Plains that were once my home."
"Say the name of the town that stands near Castle Discordia, and I'll release you."
"Ah, gunslinger, all there are dead."
"I think not. Say it."
"Fedic!"
screamed Cheven of Cheven, a wandering musica who could never have suspected its life would end in such a far, strange place. Not the plains of Midworld, but the mountains of Western Maine. It suddenly raised its horrid, glowing face to Roland. It spread its arms wide like something which has been crucified.
"Fedic, on the far side of Thunderclap, on the path of the beam, on V. Shardik, V. Maturin, the road to the dark ta—"
Roland's revolver spoke a single time. The bullet took the kneeling thing in the center of its forehead, completing the ruin of its ruined face. As it was flung backward, Eddie saw its flesh turn to greenish smoke, as ephemeral as a hornet's wing.
For a moment Eddie could see Cheven of Chavin's floating teeth like a ghostly ring of coral, and then they were gone. Roland dropped his revolver back into his holster, then pronged the 2 remaining fingers of his right hand and drew them downward in front of his face. A benedictory gesture if Eddie had ever seen one.
"Give you peace," Roland said.
Then he unbuckled his gun belt and began to roll the weapon into it once more. "Roland, was it a slow mutant?"
"Aye,
I suppose you'd say so, poor old thing. But the Rodericks are from beyond any lands I ever knew, although before the world moved on they gave their grace to Arthur Eld." He turned to Eddie, his blue eyes burning in his tired face.
"Fedic is where Mia has gone to have her baby, I have no doubt. Where she's taken Susanna, by the last castle. We must backtrack to Thunderclap eventually, but Fedic's where we need to go first. It's good to know."
"He said he felt sad for someone. Who?" Roland only shook his head, not answering Eddie's question. A Coca-Cola truck blasted by, and thunder rumbled in the far west.
"Fedic of the Discordia," the gunslinger murmured instead. "Fedic of the Red Death. If we can save Susanna and Jake, we'll backtrack toward the Kalos. But we'll return when our business there is done, and when we turn southeast again—"
"What?" Eddie asked uneasily. "What then, Roland?"
"Then there's no stopping until we reach the tower."
He held out his hands, watched them tremble minutely. Then he looked up at Eddie. His face was tired but unafraid.
"I have never been so close. I hear all my lost friends and their lost fathers whispering to me. They whisper on the tower's very breath."
Eddie looked at Roland for a minute, fascinated and frightened, and then broke the mood with an almost physical effort. "Well," he said, moving back toward the driver's door of the Ford, "if any of those voices tells you what to say to Cullum, the best way to convince him of what we want, be sure to let me know." Eddie got in the car and closed the door before Roland could reply. In his mind's eye, he kept seeing Roland leveling his big revolver, saw him aiming it at the kneeling figure and pulling the trigger. This was the man he called both Din and friend. But could he say with any certainty that Roland wouldn't do the same thing to him? Or Suze? Or Jake? If his heart told him, it would take him closer to his tower. He could not. And yet he would go on with him, would have gone on even if he'd been sure in his heart, oh God forbid, that Susanna was dead. Because he had to, because Roland had become a good deal more to him than his Din or his friend. "My father," Eddie murmured under his breath, just before Roland opened the passenger door and climbed in. "Did you speak, Eddie?" Roland asked.
"Yes," Eddie said. "Just a little farther. My very words."
Roland nodded. Eddie dropped the transmission back into drive and got the Ford rolling toward Turtleback Lane. Still in the distance, but a little closer than before, thunder rumbled again. Chapter 4 Dan Teehee 1 As the baby's time neared, Susanna Dean looked around, once more counting her enemies as Roland had taught her. "You must never draw," he'd said, "until you know how many are against you, or you've satisfied yourself that you can never know, or you've decided it's your day to die." She wished she didn't also have to cope with the terrible thought-invading helmet on her head. But whatever that thing was, it didn't seem concerned with Susanna's effort to count those present at the arrival of Mia's chap. And that was good. There was Sayre, the man in charge. The low man, with one of those red spots pulsing in the center of his forehead. There was Scowler, the doctor between Mia's legs, getting ready to officiate at the delivery. Sayre had roughed the doc up when Scowler had displayed a little too much arrogance, but probably not enough to interfere with his efficiency. There were five other low men in addition to Sayre, but she'd only picked out two names. The one with the bulldog jowls and the heavy sloping gut was Haber. Next to Haber was a bird thing with the brown feathered head and vicious beady eyes of a hawk. This creature's name seemed to be J, or possibly G. That was seven, all armed with what looked like automatic pistols in Docker's clutches. Scowthers swung carelessly out from beneath his white coat each time he bent down. Susanna had already marked that one as hers. There were also three pallid, watchful, humanoid things standing beyond Mia. These, buried in dark blue auras, were vampires, Susanna was quite sure. Probably of the sort Callahan had called Type Threes. The pair had once referred to them as pilot sharks. That made 10. Two of the vampires carried Baz, the third some sort of electrical sword now turned down to no more than a guttering core of light. If she managed to get Scowther's gun, when you get it, sweetie, she amended, she'd read the power of positive thinking, and still believed every word the Reverend Peel had written. She would turn it on the man with the electric sword first. God might know how much damage such a weapon could inflict, but Susanna Dean didn't want to find out. Also present was a nurse with the head of a great brown rat. The pulsing red eye in the center of her forehead made Susanna believe that most of the other low Falcon were wearing humanizing masks, probably so they wouldn't scare the game while out and about on the sidewalks of New York. They might not all look like rats underneath, but she was pretty sure that none of them looked like Robert Goulet. The rathead nurse was the only one present who wore no weapon that Susanna could see. 11 in all. 11 in this vast and mostly deserted infirmary that wasn't, she felt quite sure, under the borough of Manhattan. And if she was going to settle their hash, it would have to be while they were occupied with Mia's baby. Her precious chap.
"It's coming, doctor,"
the nurse cried in nervous ecstasy. It was. Susanna's counting stopped as the worst pain yet rolled over her, over both of them, burying them. They screamed in tandem. Scowther was commanding Mia to push now.
Susanna closed her eyes and also bore down, for it was her baby, too, or had been. As she felt the pain flow out of her like water whirlpooling its way down a dark drain, she experienced the deepest sorrow she had ever known. For it was Mia the baby was flowing into. The last few lines of the living message Susanna's body had somehow been made to transmit. It was ending. Whatever happened next, this part was ending. And Susanna Dean let out a cry of mingled relief and regret. A cry that was itself like a song. And then, before the horror began, something so terrible she would remember each detail as if in the glare of a brilliant light until the day of her entry into the clearing, she felt a small, hot hand grip her wrist. Susanna turned her head, rolling the unpleasant weight of the helmet with it. She could hear herself gasping. Her eyes met Mia's. Mia opened her lips and spoke a single word. Susanna couldn't hear it over Scowther's roaring. He was bending now, peering between Mia's legs and holding the forceps up and against his brow. Yet she did hear it, and understood that Mia was trying to fulfill her promise. "I'd free you if chance allows," her kidnapper had said, and the word Susanna now heard in her mind and saw on the laboring woman's lips was "Chasset."
"Susanna, do you hear me?"
"I hear you very well," Susanna said.
"And you understand our compact?"
"Aye, I'll help you get away from these with your chap, if I can, and—"
"Kill us if you can't,"
the voice finished fiercely. It had never been so loud. That was partly the work of the connecting cable, Susanna felt sure.
"Say it, Susanna, daughter of Dan."
"I'll kill you both if you—"
She stopped there. Mia seemed satisfied, however, and that was well, because Susanna couldn't have gone on if both their lives had depended on it. Her eye had happened on the ceiling of this enormous room, over the aisles of beds halfway down, and there she saw Eddie and Roland. They were hazy, floating in and out of the ceiling, looking down at her like phantom fish. Another pain, but this one not as severe. She could feel her thighs hardening, pushing, but that seemed far away, not important. What mattered was whether or not she was really seeing what she thought she was seeing. Could it be that her overstressed mind, wishing for rescue, had created this hallucination to comfort her? She could almost believe it, would have, very likely, had they not both been naked and surrounded by an odd collection of floating junk, a matchbook, a peanut, ashes, a penny, and a floor mat, by God, a car floor mat with Ford printed on it.
"Doctor, I can see the hair!"
A breathless squawk as Dr. Scowther, no gentleman, he elbowed Nurse Ratty unceremoniously aside and bent even closer to the juncture of Mia's thighs, as if he meant to pull her chap out with his teeth, perhaps. The hawk thing, J or G, was speaking to the one called Haber in an excited, buzzing dialect.
"They're really there," Susanna thought. "The floor mat proves it."
She wasn't sure how the floor mat proved it, only that it did. And she mouthed the word Mia had given her.
"Chasset."
It was a password. It would open at least one door, and perhaps many. To wonder if Mia had told the truth never even crossed Susanna's mind. They were tied together, not just by the cable and the helmets, but by the more primitive and far more powerful act of childbirth. No, Mia hadn't lied.
"Push, you God's damned lazy bitch!"
Scowther almost howled, and Roland and Eddie suddenly disappeared through the ceiling for good, as if blown away by the force of the man's breath. For all Susanna knew, they had been. She turned on her side, feeling her hair stuck to her head in clumps, aware that her body was pouring out sweat in what could have been gallons. She pulled herself a little closer to Mia, a little closer to Scowther, a little closer to the cross-hatched butt of Scowther's dangling automatic.
"Be still, sissa. Hear me, I beg," said one of the low men, and touched Susanna's arm.
The hand was cold and flabby, covered with fat rings. The caress made her skin crawl.
"This'll be over in a minute, and then all the worlds change. When this one joins the breakers in thunderclap—"
"Shut up, straw!"
Haber snapped and pushed Susanna's would-be comforter backward. Then he turned eagerly to the delivery again. Mia arched her back, groaning. The rathead nurse put her hands on Mia's hips and pushed them gently back down to the bed.
"Navi, Navi, push it thy belly.
Eat shit, you bitch!"
Mia screamed, and while Susanna felt a faint tug of her pain, that was all. The connection between them was fading. Summoning her own concentration, Susanna cried into the well of her own mind, "Hey, hey, Positronics Lady, you still there?"
"The link is down," said the pleasant female voice. As before, it spoke in the middle of Susanna's head, but unlike before, it seemed dim, no more dangerous than a voice on the radio that comes from far away due to some atmospheric flaw. "Repeat, the link is down. We hope you'll remember North Central Positronics for all your mental enhancement needs, and Sombra Corporation, a leader in mind-to-mind communication since the 10,000s. There was a tooth-rattling beep far down in Susanna's mind, and then the link was gone. It wasn't just the absence of the horridly pleasant female voice. It was everything. She felt as if she'd been let out of some painful, body-compressing trap. Mia screamed again, and Susanna let out a cry of her own. Part of this was not wanting Sayre and his mates to know the link between her and Mia had been broken. Part was genuine sorrow. She had lost a woman who had become, in a way, her true sister.
"Susanna! Suze, are you there?"
She started up on her elbows at this new voice, for a moment almost forgetting the woman beside her. That had been...
"Jake? Is it you, honey?" "It is, isn't it? Can you hear me?" "Yes," he cried. "Finally! God, who have you been talking to? Keep yelling so I can home in on you—"
The voice broke off, but not before she heard a ghostly rattle of distant gunfire. Jake shooting at someone? She thought not. She thought someone was shooting at him. 2.
"Now," Scowther shouted, "now, Mia, push for your life. Give it all you have. Push!"
Susanna tried to roll closer to the other woman. "Oh, I'm concerned and wanting comfort. See how concerned I am? Concern and wanting comfort is all it is." But the one called Straw pulled her back. The segmented steel cable swung and stretched out between them.
"Keep your distance, bitch," Straw said,
and for the first time Susanna faced the possibility that they weren't going to let her get hold of Scowther's gun, or any gun. Mia screamed again, crying out to a strange god in a strange language. When she tried to raise her midsection from the table, the nurse, Aaliyah—Susanna thought the nurse's name was Aaliyah—forced her down again, and Scowther gave a short, curt cry of what sounded like satisfaction. He tossed aside the forceps he'd been holding.
"Why do you do that?" Sayre demanded.
The sheets beneath Mia's spread legs were now damp with blood, and the boss sounded flustered.
"Won't need them," Scowther returned breezily. "She was built for babies. Could have a dozen in a rice patch and never miss a row's worth of picking. Here it comes, neat as you please."
Scowther made as if to grab the largish basin sitting on the next bed, decided he didn't have quite enough time, and slipped his pink, gloveless hands up the inside of Mia's thighs instead. This time, when Susanna made an effort to move closer to Mia, Straw didn't stop her. All of them, low men and vampires alike, were watching the last stage of the birth with complete fascination, most of them clustered at the end of the two beds which had been pushed together to make one. Only Straw was still close to Susanna. The vampire with the fire sword had just been demoted. She decided that Straw would be the first to go.
"Once more," Scowther cried, "for your baby!"
Like the low men and the vampires, Mia had forgotten Susanna, her wounded, pain-filled eyes fixed on Sayre.
"May I have him, sir? Please say I may have him, if only for a little while."
Sayre took her hand. The mask, which covered his real face, smiled. "Yes, my darling," he said, "the chap is yours for years and years. Only push this one last time."
"Mia, don't believe his lies," Susanna cried,
but the cry went nowhere. Likely that was just as well. Best she be entirely forgotten for the time being. Susanna turned her thoughts in a new direction.
"Jake! Jake, where are you?"
No answer. Not good.
Please, God, he was still alive. Maybe he's only busy. Running, hiding, fighting. Silence doesn't necessarily mean he's...
Mia howled what sounded like a string of obscenities, pushing as she did so. The lips of her already distended vagina spread further. A freshet of blood poured out, widening the muddy delta shape on the sheet beneath her. And then, through the welter of crimson, Susanna saw a crown of white and black. The white was skin, the black was hair. The mottle of white and black began to retreat into the crimson, and Susanna thought the baby would settle back, still not quite ready to come into the world. But Mia was done waiting. She pushed with all her considerable might, her hands held up before her eyes in clenched and trembling fists, her eyes slitted, her teeth bared. A vein pulsed alarmingly in the center of her forehead. Another stood out on the column of her throat.
"Hee-ah!"
she cried. "Kamala, you pretty bastard! Kamala, come! Come!"
"Dan-titi," murmured Jay, the hawk thing, and the others picked it up in a kind of reverent whisper. "Dan-titi, Dan-titi, Kamala, Dan-titi." The coming of the little god.
This time, the baby's head did not just crown, but rushed forward. Susanna saw his hands held against his blood-spattered chest in tiny fists that trembled with life. She saw blue eyes, wide open and startling in both their awareness and their similarity to Roland's. She saw sooty black lashes. Tiny beads of blood jeweled them, barbaric natal finery. Susanna saw, and would never forget, how the baby's lower lip momentarily caught on the inner lip of his mother's vulva. The baby's mouth was pulled briefly open, revealing a perfect row of little teeth in the lower jaw. They were teeth, not fangs, but perfect little teeth. Yet still, to see them in the mouth of a newborn gave Susanna a chill. So did the sight of the chap's penis, disproportionately large and fully erect. Susanna guessed it was longer than her little finger. Howling in pain and triumph, Mia surged up on her elbows, her eyes bulging and streaming tears. She reached out and seized Sayre's hand in a grip of iron as Scouther deftly caught the baby. Sayre yelped and tried to pull away, but he might as well have tried to, well, to pull away from a deputy sheriff in Oxford, Mississippi. The little chant had died, and there was a moment of shocked silence. In it, Susanna's overstrained ears clearly heard the sound of bones grinding in Sayre's wrist.
"Does he live?"
Mia shrieked into Sayre's startled face. Spittle flew from her lips.
"Tell me, you poxy whoreson, if my chap lives!"
Scouther lifted the chap so that he and the child were face to face. The doctor's brown eyes met the baby's blue ones, and as the chap hung there in Scouther's grip, with its penis jutting defiantly upward, Susanna clearly saw the crimson mark on the babe's left heel. It was as if that foot had been dipped in blood just before the baby left Mia's womb. Rather than spanking the baby's buttocks, Scouther drew in a breath and blew it in puffs directly into the chap's eyes. Mia's chap blinked in comical and undeniably human surprise. It drew in a breath of its own, held it for a moment, then let it out. King of kings he might be, or the destroyer of worlds, but he embarked upon life as had so many before him, squalling with outrage. Mia burst into glad tears at the sound of that cry. The devilish creatures gathered around the new mother were bondservants of the Crimson King, but that didn't make them immune to what they had just witnessed. They broke into applause and laughter. Susanna was not a little disgusted to find herself joining them. The baby looked around at the sound, his expression one of clear amazement. Weeping, with tears running down her cheeks and clear snot dripping from her nose, Mia held out her arms.
"Give him to me,"
wept she. So wept Mia, daughter of none and mother of one.
"Let me hold him, I beg. Let me hold my son. Let me hold my chap. Let me hold my precious."
And the baby turned its head to the sound of his mother's voice. Susanna would have said such a thing was impossible, but of course she would have said a baby born wide awake, with a mouthful of teeth and a boner, was impossible as well. Yet in every other way the babe seemed completely normal to her, chubby and well-formed, human and thus dear. There was the red mark on his heel, yes, but how many children, normal in every other regard, were born with some sort of birthmark? Hadn't her own father been born red-handed, according to family legend? This mark wouldn't even show, unless the kid was at the beach. Still holding the newborn up to his face, Scouther looked at Sayre. There was a momentary pause, during which Susanna could easily have seized Scouther's automatic. She didn't even think of doing it. She'd forgotten Jake's telepathic cry, had likewise forgotten her weird visit from Roland and her husband. She was as enwrapped as Jay and Straw and Haber and all the rest, enwrapped at this moment of a child's arrival in a worn-out world. Sayre nodded, almost imperceptibly, and Scouther lowered baby Mordred, still wailing and still looking over his shoulder, apparently for his mother, into Mia's waiting arms. Mia turned him around at once, so she could look at him. And Susanna's heart froze with dismay and horror, for Mia had run mad. It was brilliant in her eyes, it was in the way her mouth managed to sneer and smile at the same time, while drool, pinked and thickened with blood from her bitten tongue, trickled down the sides of her chin. Most of all, it was in her triumphant laughter. She might come back to sanity in the days ahead, but—
"Bitch ain't never coming back,"
Detta said, not without sympathy.
"Getting this far and then getting shed of it done broke her. She busted, and you know it as well as I do."
"Oh, such beauty,"
Mia crooned. "Oh, see thy blue eyes, thy skin as white as the sky before wide earth's first snow. See thy nipples, such perfect berries they are. See thy prick and thy balls, as smooth as new peaches."
She looked around, first at Susanna, her eyes skating over Susanna's face with absolutely no recognition, and then at the others.
"See, my chap, ye unfortunates, ye gonics, my precious, my baby, my boy."
She shouted to them, demanded of them, laughing with her mad eyes and crying with her crooked mouth,
"See what I gave up eternity for? See my Mordred. See him very well, for never will you see another his like."
Panting harshly, she covered the baby's bloody, staring face with kisses, smearing her mouth until she looked like a drunk who has tried to put on lipstick. She laughed and kissed the chubby flap of his infant's double chin, his nipples, his navel, the jutting tip of his penis, and, holding him up higher and higher in her trembling arms, the child she meant to call Mordred goggling down at her with that comic look of astonishment, she kissed his knees and then each tiny foot. Susanna heard that room's first suckle, not the baby at his mother's breast, but Mia's mouth on each perfectly shaped toe. 3. "Yon child's my din's doom," Susanna thought coldly. "If I do nothing else, I could seize Scouther's gun and shoot it. 'Twould be the work of 2 seconds. With her speed, her uncanny gunslinger's speed, this was likely true. But she found herself unable to move. She had foreseen many outcomes to this act of the play, but not Mia's madness, never that. And it had caught her entirely by surprise. It crossed Susanna's mind that she was lucky indeed that the positronics link had gone down when it had. If it hadn't, she might be as mad as Mia. And that link could kick back in, sister. Don't you think you better make your move while you still can? But she couldn't. That was the thing. She was frozen in wonder, held in thrall. "Stop that," Sayre snapped at her. "Your job isn't to slurp at him, but to feed him. If you'd keep him, hurry up. Give him suck. Or should I summon a wet nurse? There are many who'd give their eyes for the opportunity."
"Never in your life,"
Mia cried, laughing, but she lowered the child to her chest and impatiently brushed aside the bodice of the plain white gown she wore, baring her right breast. Susanna could see why men would be taken by her. Even now that breast was a perfect coral-tipped globe that seemed more fit for a man's hand and a man's lust than a baby's nourishment. Mia lowered the chap to it. For a moment he rooted, as comically as he'd goggled at her, his face striking the nipple and then seeming to bounce off. When it came down again, however, the pink rose of his mouth closed on the erect pink bud of her breast and began to suck. Mia stroked the chap's tangled and blood-soaked black curls, still laughing. To Susanna, her laughter sounded like screams. There was a clumping on the floor as a robot approached. It looked quite a bit like Andy the messenger robot, same skinny 7 or 8 foot height, same electric blue eyes, same many-jointed gleaming body, In its arms, it bore a large glass box filled with green light.
"What's that fucking thing for?"
Sayre snapped. He sounded both pissed off and incredulous.
"An incubator," Scowther said. "I felt it would be better to be safe than sorry."
When he turned to look, his shoulder-holstered gun swung toward Susanna. It was an even better chance, the best she'd ever have, and she knew it, but before she could take it, Mia's chap changed. 4. Susanna saw red light run down the child's smooth skin from the crown of its head to the stained heel of its right foot. It was not a flush, but a flash, lighting the child from without. Susanna would have sworn it. And then, as it lay upon Mia's deflated stomach with its lips clamped around her nipple, the red flash was followed by a blackness that rose up and spread, turning the child into a lightless gnome, a negative of the rosy baby that had escaped Mia's womb. At the same time, its body began to shrivel, its legs pulling up and melting into its belly, its head sliding down and pulling Mia's breast with it into its neck, which puffed up like the throat of a toad. Its blue eyes turned to tar, then back to blue again. Susanna tried to scream and could not. Tumors swelled along the black thing's sides, then burst and extruded legs. The red mark which had ridden the heel was still visible, but now had become a blob like the crimson brand on a black widow spider's belly. For that was what this thing was, a spider. Yet the baby was not entirely gone. A white excrescence rose from the spider's back. In it, Susanna could see a tiny, deformed face and blue sparks that were eyes.
"What?"
Mia asked, and started up on her elbows once again. Blood had begun to pour from her breast. The baby drank it, like milk, losing not a drop. Beside Mia, Sayre was standing as still as a graven image, his mouth open and his eyes bulging from their sockets. Whatever he'd expected from this birth, whatever he'd been told to expect, it wasn't this. The deader part of Susanna took a child's vicious pleasure in the man's shocked expression. He looked like the comedian Jack Benny milking a laugh. For a moment only, Mia seemed to realize what had happened. For her face began to lengthen with a kind of informed horror and perhaps pain. Then her smile returned, that angelic Madonna's smile. She reached out and stroked the still-changing freak at her breast, the black spider with the tiny human head and the red mark on its bristly gut.
"Is he not beautiful?" she cried. "Is my son not beautiful? As fair as the summer sun?"
These were her last words. 5. Her face didn't freeze exactly, but stilled. Her cheeks and brow and throat, flushed dark with the exertions of childbirth only a moment before, faded to the waxy whiteness of orchid petals. Her shining eyes grew still and fixed in their sockets, and suddenly it was as if Susanna were looking not at a woman lying on a bed, but the drawing of a woman. An extraordinarily good one, but still something that had been created on paper with strokes of charcoal and a few pale colors. Susanna remembered how she had returned to the Plaza Park Hyatt Hotel after her first visit to the allure of Castle Discordia, and how she'd come here to Fedic after her last palaver with Mia in the shelter of the Merlin. How the sky and the castle and the very stone of the Merlin had torn open. And then, as if her thought had caused it, Mia's face was ripped apart from hairline to chin. Her fixed and dulling eyes fell crookedly away to either side, her lips split into a crazy double-twin grin, and it wasn't blood that poured out of that widening fissure in her face, but a stale-smelling white powder. Susanna had a fragmented memory of T.S. Eliot. Hollow men, stuffed men, headpiece filled with straw. And Lewis Carroll, "Why, you're nothing but a pack of cards." Before Mia's Dantiti raised its unspeakable head from its first meal. Its blood-smeared mouth opened, and it hoisted itself, lower legs scrabbling for purchase on its mother's deflating belly, upper ones almost seeming to shadow box at Susanna. It squealed with triumph, and if it had at that moment chosen to attack the other woman who had given it nurture, Susanna Dean would surely have died next to me. Instead, it returned to the deflated sack of breast from which it had taken its first suck, and tore it off. The sound of its chewing was wet and loose. A moment later, it burrowed into the hole it had made, the white human face disappearing while Mia's was obliterated by the dust boiling out of her deflating head. There was a harsh, almost industrial sucking sound, and Susanna thought, "It's taking all the moisture out of her. All the moisture that's left. And look at it. Look at it swell, like a leech on a horse's neck." Just then, a ridiculously English voice, it was the plummy intonation of the lifelong gentleman's gentleman, said,
"Pardon me, sirs, but will you be wanting this incubator after all? For the situation seems to have altered somewhat, if you don't mind my saying."
It broke Susanna's paralysis. She pushed herself upward with one hand and seized Scowther's automatic pistol with the other. She yanked, but the gun was strapped across the butt and wouldn't come free. Her questing index finger found the little sliding knob that was the safety and pushed it. She turned the gun, holster and all, toward Scowther's ribcage. "What the dev—" he began, and then she pulled the trigger with her middle finger, at the same time yanking back on the shoulder rig with all her force. The straps binding the holster to Scowther's body held, but the thinner one holding the automatic in place snapped, and as Scowther fell sideways, trying to look down at the smoking black hole in his white lab coat, Susanna took full possession of his gun. She shot Straw and the vampire beside him, the one with the electric sword. For a moment the vampire was there, still staring at the spider god that had looked so much like a baby to begin with, and then its aura whiffed out. The thing's flesh went with it. For a moment there was nothing where it had been but an empty shirt tucked into an empty pair of blue jeans. Then the clothes collapsed. "Kill her!" Sayre screamed, reaching for his own gun. "Kill that bitch!" Susanna rolled away from the spider, crouched on the body of its rapidly deflating mother, raking at the helmet she was wearing even as she tumbled off the side of the bed. There was a moment of excruciating pain when she thought it wasn't going to come away, and then she hit the floor, free of it. It hung over the side of the bed, fringed with her hair. The spider thing, momentarily pulled off its roost when its mother's body jerked, chittered angrily. Susanna rolled beneath the bed as a series of gunshots went off above her. She heard a loud sproink as one of the slugs hit a spring. She saw the rathead nurse's feet and hairy lower legs and put a bullet into one of her knees. The nurse gave a scream, turned, and began to limp away, squalling. Sarah leaned forward, pointing the gun at the makeshift double bed just beyond Mia's deflating body. There were already three smoking, smoldering holes in the ground sheet. Before he could add a fourth, one of the spider's legs caressed his cheek, tearing open the mask he wore and revealing the hairy cheek beneath. Sayre recoiled, crying out. The spider turned to him and made a mewling noise. The white thing high on its back, a node with a human face, glared as if to warn Sayre away from its meal. Then it turned back to the woman, who was really not recognizable as a woman any longer. She looked like the ruins of some incredibly ancient mummy which had now turned to rags and powder.
"I say, this is a bit confusing," the robot with the incubator remarked. "Shall I retire? Perhaps I might return when matters have clarified somewhat."
Susanna reversed direction, rolling out from beneath the bed. She saw that two of the low men had taken to their heels. Jay, the Hawkman, didn't seem to be able to make up his mind, stay or go. Susanna made it up for him, putting a single shot into the sleek brown head. Blood and feathers flew. Susanna got up as well as she could, gripping the side of the bed for balance, holding Scowther's gun out in front of her. She had gotten four, the redhead nurse and one other had run. Sayre had dropped his gun and was trying to hide behind the robot with the incubator. Susanna shot the two remaining vampires and the low man with the bulldog face. That one, Haber, hadn't forgotten Susanna. He'd been holding his ground and waiting for a clear shot. She got hers first, and watched him fall backward with deep satisfaction. Haber, she thought, had been the most dangerous.
"Madam, I wonder if you could tell me—" began the robot, and Susanna put two quick shots into its steel face, darkening the blue electric eyes. This trick she had learned from Eddie. A gigantic siren immediately went off. Susanna felt that if she listened to it long, she would be deafened. "I have been blinded by gunfire,"
the robot bellowed, still in its absurd, "Would you like another cup of tea, madam?" accent. "Vision Zero, I need help. Code 7, I say, help!" Sayre stepped away from it, hands held high. Susanna couldn't hear him over the siren and the robot's blatting, but she could read the words as they came off the bastard's lips. "I surrender. Will you accept my parole?" She smiled at this amusing idea, unaware that she smiled. It was without humor and without mercy, and meant only one thing. She wished she could get him to lick her stumps, as he had forced Mia to lick his boots. But there wasn't time enough. He saw his doom in her grin and turned to run, and Susanna shot him twice in the back of the head, once for Mia, once for Per Callahan. Sayre's skull shattered in a fury of blood and brains. He grabbed the wall, scrabbled at a shelf loaded with equipment and supplies, and then went down dead. Susanna now took aim at the spider god, the tiny white human head on its black and bristly back turned to look at her. The blue eyes, so uncannily like Roland's, blazed.
"No, you cannot. You must not. For I am the king's only son."
"I can't," she sent back, leveling the automatic. "Oh, sugar, you are just so wrong."
But before she could pull the trigger, there was a gunshot from behind her. A slug burned across the side of her neck. Susanna reacted instantly, turning and throwing herself sideways into the aisle. One of the low men who'd run had had a change of heart and come back.
Susanna put two bullets into his chest and made him mortally sorry.
She turned, eager for more. Yes, this was what she wanted, what she had been made for, and she'd always revere Roland for showing her, but the others were either dead or fled. The spider raced down the side of its birthbed on its many legs, leaving the papier-mâché corpse of its mother behind. It turned its white infant's head briefly toward her.
"You do well to let me pass, Blackie, or—"
She fired at it, but stumbled over the Hawkman's outstretched hand as she did. The bullet that would have killed the abomination went a little awry, clipping off one of its 8 hairy legs instead.
A yellowish-red fluid, more like pus than blood, poured from the place where the leg had joined the body. The thing screamed at her in pain and surprise. The audible portion of that scream was hard to hear over the endless cycling blat of the robot's siren, but she heard it in her head loud and clear.
"I'll pay you back for that. My father and I, we'll pay you back. Make you cry for death, so we will."
"You ain't going to have a chance, sugar," Susanna sent back, trying to project all the confidence she possibly could, not wanting the thing to know what she believed, that Scather's automatic might have been shot dry. She aimed with a deliberation that was unnecessary, and the spider scuttled rapidly away from her, darting first behind the endlessly sirening robot, and then through a dark doorway. All right, not great, not the best solution by any means, but she was still alive, and that much was grand. And the fact that all of Cy Sayre's crew were dead or run off, that wasn't bad either. Susanna tossed Scowther's gun aside and selected another, this one a Walther PPK. She took it from the docker's clutch Straw had been wearing, then rummaged in his pockets, where she found half a dozen extra clips. She briefly considered adding the vampire's electric sword to her armory and decided to leave it where it was. Better the tools you knew than those you didn't. She tried to get in touch with Jake, couldn't hear herself think, and turned to the robot.
"Hey, big boy, shut off that damn siren. What do you say?"
She had no idea if it would work, but it did. The silence was immediate and wonderful, with a sensuous texture of moiré silk. Silence might be useful. If there was a counterattack, she'd hear them coming. And the dirty truth? She hoped for a counterattack, wanted them to come, and never mind whether that made sense or not. She had a gun, and her blood was up. That was all that mattered.
"Jake, Jake, do you hear me, kiddo? If you hear, answer your big sis."
Nothing. Not even that rattle of distant gunfire. He was out of it, then a single word. Was it a word?
"Wimowe."
More important, was it Jake? She didn't know for sure, but she thought yes. And the words seemed familiar to her somehow. Susanna gathered her concentration, meaning to call louder this time, and then a queer idea came to her, one too strong to be called intuition. Jake was trying to be quiet. He was hiding? Maybe getting ready to spring an ambush? The idea sounded crazy, but maybe his blood was up, too. She didn't know, but thought he'd either sent her that one odd word, Wimoe, on purpose, or it had slipped out. Either way, it might be better to let him roll his own oats for a while.
"I say, I have been blinded by gunfire," the robot insisted. Its voice was still loud, but had dropped to a range at least approaching normal. "I can't say a bloody thing, and I have this incubator."
"Drop it," Susanna said.
"But drop it, Chumley." "I beg pardon, madam, but my name is Nigel the Butler, and I really can't—"
Susanna had been hauling herself closer during this little exchange. You didn't forget the old means of locomotion just because you'd been granted a brief vacation with legs, she was discovering, and read both the name and the serial number stamped on the robot's chrome steel midsection.
"Nigel DNK45932, drop that fucking glass box, say thank you."
The robot, "Domestic," was stamped just below its serial number, dropped the incubator, and then whimpered when it shattered at its steel feet. Susanna worked her way over to Nigel and found she had to conquer a moment's fear before reaching up and taking one three-fingered steel hand. She needed to remind herself that this wasn't Andy from Calla Bryn Sturgis. Nor could Nigel know about Andy. The butler robot might or might not be sophisticated enough to crave revenge. Certainly Andy had been, but you couldn't crave what you didn't know about. She hoped.
"Nigel, pick me up."
There was a whine of servo motors as the robot bent.
"No, hon, you have to come forward a little bit. There's broken glass where you are." "Pardon, madam, but I'm blind. I believe it was you who shot my eyes out."
"Oh, that." "Well," she said, hoping her tone of irritation would disguise the fear beneath,
"I can't very well get you new ones if you don't pick me up, can I? Now get a wiggle on, may it do you. Time's wasting."
Nigel stepped forward, crushing broken glass beneath its feet, and came to the sound of her voice. Susanna controlled the urge to cringe back, but once the domestic robot had set its grip on her, its touch was quite gentle. It lifted her into its arms.
"Now take me to the door." "Madam, beg pardon, but there are many doors in 16, more still beneath the castle."
"How many?"
Susanna couldn't help being curious. A brief pause. "I should say 595 are currently operational."
She immediately noticed that 595 added up to 19. Added up to Chasset.
"Do you mind giving me a carry to the one I came through before the shooting started?"
Susanna pointed toward the far end of the room.
"No, madam, I don't mind at all, but I'm sorry to tell you that it will do you no good," Nigel said in his plummy voice. "That door, New York, number 7, Fedic, is one way."
A pause, relays clicking in the steel dome of its head.
"Also, it burned out after its last use. It has, as you might say, gone to the clearing at the end of the path."
"Oh, that's just wonderful,"
Susanna cried, but realized she wasn't exactly surprised by Nigel's news. She remembered the ragged humming sound she'd heard it making just before Sayre had pushed her rudely through it, remembered thinking even in her distress that it was a dying thing. And yes, it had died.
"Just wonderful."
"I sense you are distressed, madam."
"You're goddamn right I'm distressed. Bad enough the damn thing only opened one way, now it's shut down completely."
"Except for the default," Nigel agreed.
"Default? What do you mean, default?"
"That would be New York number 9, Fedic," Nigel told her. "At one time there were over 30 one-way New York to Fedic ports, but I believe number 9 is the only one that remains. All commands pertaining to New York number 7, Fedic, will now have defaulted to number 9.
"Chasset," she thought, almost prayed. "He's talking about Chasset, I think. Oh, God, I hope he is."
"Do you mean passwords and such, Nigel?"
"Why, yes, madam."
"Take me to door number 9.
"As you wish."
Nigel began to move rapidly up the aisle between the hundreds of empty beds, their taut white sheets gleaming under the brilliant overhead lamps. Susanna's imagination momentarily populated this room with screaming, frightened children freshly arrived from Calla Bryn Sturgis, maybe from the neighboring colors as well. She saw not just a single redhead nurse, but battalions of them, eager to clamp the helmets over the heads of the kidnapped children and start the process that did what? Ruined them in some way. sucked the intelligence out of their heads, and knocked their growth hormones out of whack and ruined them forever. Susanna supposed that at first they would be cheered up to hear such a pleasant voice in their heads, a voice welcoming them to the wonderful world of North Central Positronics and the Sombra Group. Their crying would stop, their eyes fill with hope. Perhaps they would think the nurses in their white uniforms were good in spite of their hairy, scary faces and yellow fangs. As good as the voice of the nice lady. And the hum would begin, quickly building in volume as it moved toward the middle of their heads, and this room would again fill with their frightened screams.
"Madam, are you all right?"
"Yes, why do you ask, Nigel?"
"I believe you shivered."
"Never mind. Just get me to the door to New York, the one that still works."